wall behind him, pressing the heels of his hands into his eyes.
Ben died?
I sympathize with him. It doesn't feel real to me either. I still can't wrap my head around any of this. Xander, you gotta think. Did he say anything about where he was going? Anything that might tell us where he is? I don't think he's in his right mind. I'm really fucking worried. When Xander drops his hands, his eyes are red and bloodshot. He clears his throat.
Yeah,
frowning, he shrugs.
He said something about going to see his mom. He stormed out of here without a jacket. He said he wouldn't need it. He took the scout.
He rode the bike? I look around, surveying the chaos and destruction that is Alex's apartment, trying to mentally add up how many units of alcohol are still churning around his system. I throw my hands up in the air, turning toward the door, then turning right back again.
He's fucking dead, I whisper. He's probably driven head-on into a Mack truck, and now he's fucking dead too.
Tense, and with a face whiter than a sheet, Xander shoves away from the wall.
No need to get melodramatic, Parisi. If we're lucky, he might have just paralyzed himself from the waist down. You said the funeral's this morning?
I nod, fighting the urge to dash into the kitchen and throw up in the sink. I could have done without the thought that Alex might ironically share the same fate as Killian Dupree.
Yeah, in 20 minutes.
Then that's where we're going. He wouldn't miss Ben's funeral. Come on, I'm coming over there with you, he says, shaking his head. Jesus fucking Christ, I can't believe this is even fucking happening.
4. Silver. The driver doesn't say a word about Xander's robe or the fact that the jeans he quickly put on are shredded beyond all functionality. His lips remain sealed in a tight, disapproving line as he drives us to the church. Greenwood Presbyterian is on the outskirts of Raleigh, set high on the side of a hill that overlooks town. It was the very first structure erected here before the quaint stores on Main Street were built, or the warehouses and factories owned by the Weaving family for generations began to monopolize Raleigh's modest skyline. The four families who founded Raleigh decided the townspeople would need God more than anything else, and so they made a house of worship their first priority. When we pull up outside the church, Xander and I bolt from the town car, hurrying inside the building. The large, solid wooden doors crash open, startling the figure dressed in white standing in front of the lectern in the church's apse. My legs nearly go out from underneath when I see the small, half-sized coffin at the head of the pews, festooned with sunflowers. Xander grabs my hand, pulling me behind him up the aisle, head sweeping from left to right.
He isn't here. Mr. Moretti, the priest calls from the apse. Welcome. I took the liberty of... Nope, not Alex, Xander replies. He hasn't been here?
Closer now, I see that the priest is ancient, in his late 70s, his bald head freckled with age spots. His eyes are clouded by cataracts and watery, giving him the look of a man permanently on the brink of tears. He shakes his head.
You're the first to arrive this morning, I'm afraid, he says.
Fuck!
Xander claps a hand over his mouth.
Fuck, sorry, Father. I didn't mean to... Damn it, I'm just gonna stop talking. You take over,
he says, pushing me forward. I'm sorry, Father. We've kind of lost Alessandro. Is there any way the service can be held for a while? Just an hour while we look for him? The priest's face crumples into a maze of deep lines, a mourning mask, a face that has creased in sympathy too many times to count.
I'm so sorry, my dear. If it were any other day of the week, I would of course say yes. Today's Saturday, though, and New Year's Eve to boot. We have two weddings this afternoon. The first guests arrive in an hour. If Benjamin is to have a religious service, then I'm afraid we really must start now.
I can't be here without him. I can't. Shit, it wouldn't be right to sit here through Ben's funeral service without Alex. Selfishly, I don't think I can make it through the service without him. I don't feel that strong.
If you don't stay, then Ben's not going to have anyone here with him. No one that he knows,
Xander says, his voice pitchy and uneven. He's battling with his emotions, though he's doing a stellar job. His cracked voice is the only sign that he's struggling. And he's just said the one thing that will enable me to get through an entire funeral service for a little boy on my own. Ben won't have anyone here with him. It's been eating me alive, the fact that he was alone when he died. There's nothing I can do about that now. But I can stay at the church and be here for this. I can stay with him so that he's not alone for this part of his final journey.
Okay, you go then, I say to Xander.
Go, find him. Bring him to the cemetery as quickly as you can. He can't do this. He needs to say goodbye or he's never gonna heal. Even if Xander can find Alex and he does get him to the cemetery in time for Ben's interment, saying goodbye isn't going to be enough. I know that. Alex can say goodbye to his brother 1,000 times over, every morning and every night until his lips are chapped and bleeding from the repetition. But it won't help him heal. Only time will do that, and I have no idea how many weeks or months or years will be enough to accomplish that. Still, he has to be there. He's going to hate himself for the rest of his life if he doesn't show up for this.
5. Alex. They used to play stupid games back at Denny. There was little to do besides work out, watch the same family game shows on repeat, and pretend to study in the library. So to appease the mind-numbing boredom, my fellow inmates bombarded one another with a litany of pointless questions. Would you rather was a favorite. Would you rather get your dick sucked by a Kardashian or fuck Taylor Swift in the ass? Win the lottery and die at 50, or live till you're 100 but be broke as fuck? During one of the last rounds of Would You Rather, I played before I walked out of Denny. Harrison Ash asked me, would I rather be deaf or blind? At the time, I thought it was an easy one, a no-brainer. I'd told him I'd rather go blind. For months, I'd been dying to play my guitar, my fingers itching to fly up and down the neck of the instrument I'd had to leave in Gary Quincy's garage. All I'd had to stare at were bland gray walls and the ugly-as-fuck faces of the other dumb bastards I'd been locked away with. I'd forgotten that there was beauty in the world. It seemed that without music, I'd lost a piece of my soul, and the concept of losing it forever was pure fucking torture to me. Amazing how quickly a mind can change when the world starts falling apart. Sitting in a pew of Raleigh's Holy Trinity Catholic Church, the depth of the silence that cloaks the darkened alcoves in recessed confessional roars. The pressure of it butts up against my eardrums, a smoldering quality to it, and I can't help but feel relieved. No one asking me if there's anything they can do. I don't know, how about you bring my dead kid brother back to life? No one giving me stupid fucking advice on how to navigate the hazardous terrain of grief and loss, and how this too shall fucking pass. You don't think I've been here before? You don't think I've sat down and dined on the same bitter food as the Grim Reaper himself? We're best fucking friends, asshole. No one asking me if I'm okay. No, of course I am not fucking okay. What the fuck is wrong with you? On what planet would I actually be fucking okay? If I'm deaf to the endless questions and the sickening pity in their voices, then I don't have to keep my temper at bay. I don't have to force myself to swallow my angry responses down where they burn at the back of my throat like acid-filled blisters. I've gone so long with people pretending I don't exist that now they're all racked with sympathy and guilt, going out of their way to check in on me. I don't know how to handle their attention. I don't want it. I don't fucking need it. I need for all of this to go away, to have never fucking happened in the first place. I need, God, more than anything, I just need Silver. A stab of guilt pinches in my chest. I should be with her right now. She would have already gone to the apartment looking for me, but I just couldn't be there. If I'd stayed, she would have talked me off the ledge. Those beautiful blue eyes of hers would have met mine, and I would have gone with her, if only to stem her hurt during the ordeal of yet another goddamn funeral. I had to get out of there before I could see her dressed in her mourning clothes, and my own sense of duty kicked in. I could not fucking sit in a pew at the front of a depressingly empty Presbyterian church, staring numbly at a coffin, knowing that Ben's lifeless, cold body was inside it. It would have taken my very last energy reserves, along with what little remains of my will to live, to make it through a service like that, and I need both to ensure I don't throw myself in Lake Cushman tomorrow morning. How simple would it be to let the clear glacial water flood me, fill me up, and drag me down into the darkness? Seems like such a logical solution to the problem that I'm currently faced with. I'm hurting. I'm suffering beyond any measure I've previously experienced. If I sank below the still mirrored surface of the lake and let the patient waters take me, then it would be done with. No more pain. No more suffering. Except, suicide's never going to be an option for me. Not while Silver draws breath. I know what it is to be left behind, tossed and turned in the wake after someone you love punches their ticket on that one-way journey. It's a fate worse than death to exist in a world where the person you love decided it was better to die than stay behind and love you back. It isn't that simple. It's never that simple. But that's how it fucking feels. My mother was haunted by her ghosts. In the last 2 or 3 years before she died, she never knew a moment's peace. The black dog was always crouched over her, baring its teeth, refusing to let her up even for a second. And through it all, she tried. She woke up every morning and made herself get out of bed, and she tried. Most days she failed. She was angry. She was manic. She hallucinated, and she kicked and screamed. Exhaustion drove her to put the muzzle of that gun in her mouth, and despair made her pull the trigger. It took a long time for me to accept that what she did that day didn't mean that she didn't love me enough. It was just that the pain and the endless, bottomless agony of being alive was too big for her to overcome in the end. If I took myself out, eventually Silver would come to the same realization. Before that, she'd know the same brilliant, blinding kind of pain that I felt as a 6-year-old boy, and I could never fucking do that to her. Ironically, I'd die before I ever put her through something like that. A trickle of incense hits the back of my nose, bringing me back into myself. I've been so absent for days now that I'm always kind of shocked when I snap out of my reveries and realize that I've somehow found my way across Raleigh. Or, in this instance, to Holy Trinity, a Catholic church, because my mother was Catholic. That's how Ben and I were raised. Ben should have been brought here for his funeral service, but I wasn't thinking straight when the funeral home informed me that Jackie's will stated all services should be conducted as per her Presbyterian faith. I should have demanded the arrangements be changed. Jackie had no right to include Ben in her will in the first place. But it had already taken everything I had to make sure Ben was buried here instead of back in Bellingham. Holy Trinity is soaked in the same rich, velveteen sublimity that all Catholic churches share, a humble reverence that's momentarily calmed the restless void in my chest. People mistake the healing atmosphere inside buildings like this for the presence of God all the time. It's awe-inspiring. To feel the soul salved simply by walking inside a specific building and sitting quietly for a while. That's the thing, though. Madness grips people's lives at every fucking turn. Kids, bills, work, financial stress, the expectations and hopes of others. Everywhere they turn, there's so much noise and chatter and fucking insanity that the first moment they get to sit in the silent dark and breathe, they're bound to feel like they're communing with the sublime. That's why I came here, after all. Because this is a good place to think.
Eterno riposo concedere a loro, o Signore, e lasciare che perpetua risplenda ad essi la luce. Maggio le anime dei fedeli defunti attraverso il ricordo di Dio. Riposa in pace. Amen.
The words aren't welcome. I haven't searched them out, but they push to the surface of my memory anyway, shoving aside my other thoughts. I remember the susurrus of her voice, catching on the consonants and vowels, creating a melody out of the prayer every All Souls Day in November. I knew Thanksgiving was only a few weeks away when my mother decked our apartment out with chrysanthemums, set 3 extra places at the table, and lay out food for people I'd never met before. Nor would I, since they were all dead. My grandparents were long gone by the time I was born, so my uncle, her half-brother, who managed to fall from the 3rd-floor balcony of a hotel room in Rome when he was drunk and landed on his head. She'd cook every single Italian recipe she could remember from her childhood, and then she'd wrap me up in my thickest winter jacket, and we'd go knocking on our neighbors' doors, offering them dolce di morti, the sweets of the dead. She'd told me that the small white biscuits were supposed to sweeten the bitterness of death, and that in Italy, children would knock on doors for them along with other candies and treats in return for a prayer for the dead.
Eterno riposo concedere a loro, o Signore, e lasciare che perpetua risplenda ad essi la luce. Maggio le anime dei fedeli defunti attraverso il ricordo di Dio. Riposa in pace. Amen.
All Souls Day is long behind us now, but my mother's voice chants her prayers regardless. The door to the church groans, and a rush of cold air makes my arms break out in goosebumps. Someone has just come in. Part of me is irritated that the silence is going to be marred by someone else's presence. Then again, I'm glad I'm not alone anymore. Another second of solitude, and I might never have resurfaced again. I thought I might find you here, a gruff voice says behind me. Not the voice of a priest, that's for sure. Far too whiskey-soaked. The hairs on the back of my neck stand to attention, an alertness returning to me that's been gone ever since I answered that stupid fucking door to Maeve. For a second I think it's Xander, come to drag me to the funeral at Greenwood. But then,
heard you were living here in Raleigh. Guess I didn't really believe it. Not till now.
Being tased is a unique experience, hard to describe. Your body locks up, screaming in pain, jaw clenched, hands clenched, asshole clenched, fucking everything clenched, and your mind is screaming at you to move, get away from the pain, but you can't. You're frozen in place, lungs seized, and all you can do is lay there and take it. I've never felt anything like it before. Until this moment right now. If the best memories of my childhood are of my mother, then the worst, without a shadow of a doubt, are of my father. Even when she was manic and hysterical, making wild, outlandish threats, he was still worse, because he was indifferent, and then he was fucking gone. Over the years, I've tried to erase the stain of him from my head. But Giacomo Moretti has always been paradoxically indelible. And now it seems as though he's standing right behind me. I don't turn around. I hear him, the scuff of old worn boot soles against the stone floor, the huff that comes out of him as he sinks down onto the pew behind mine. I smell him too, cold winter air and snow, engine grease and clove cigarettes.
You're bigger than I thought you'd be.
He says it casually, like he's commenting on unexpectedly good weather to a stranger.
You were a scrawny mite when you were little, way shorter than the other kids at school.
Alex, do not turn around. Giacomo, Jack, is quiet for a moment, as if he has every right to waltz in here and destroy my peace, and he isn't planning on losing any sleep over it. Meanwhile, my synapses are firing so rapidly and randomly that I can't formulate a single thought beyond kill him. A tapping sound breaks the silence, the toe of his boot knocking against the underside of my pew directly beneath me.
I came because, well, you know why I came. I came because of Benny.
My first words to my father in over 10 years are this. I'm surprised you even remembered his name. The stranger behind me sucks on his teeth disapprovingly. Come on now, eh? That's not very fair. Of course I remember his name. He was my son. No. Somewhere outside, a car horn keens. 10 seconds later, a young woman enters through a door at the head of the church and dips to her knees before the life-sized depiction of Christ on the cross. She prays, quickly crosses herself, and then hurries down the aisle toward the exit. The sound of the heavy door closing after her echoes for what feels like an eternity. Giacomo's had plenty of time to stew on his response.
I'm sorry. What do you mean, no?
You weren't his father. You were the guy who lived with our mother for a couple of years, knocked her up twice, cost her the national debt of a small country and lost fucking bail money, sold our television, then fucking disappeared off the face of the planet. I don't mean to keep taking breaks before each statement. I just can't speak properly. I never thought an emotion would be able to eclipse the grief I've been experiencing the past few days, but I was wrong. The fury hurtling along my nerve endings and forging fires within my bones is like white lightning. Giacomo laughs under his breath.
Alessandro, you have no idea what you're talking about. I didn't just up and disappear. No, she made me leave. You were too young to remember the fights, the screaming. I wasn't perfect, son, but your mother was fucking crazy. I could give two shits about being in a house of God. I twist, spinning around, hurling myself at the back of the pew, practically throwing myself over it. Suddenly I have a handful of t-shirt material in my left fist, and my right is raised high above my head, ready to come crashing down into the miserable fucker's face, which is so much like my own. He doesn't blink, doesn't even react to the fact that I've grabbed hold of him and I'm about to knock his front fucking teeth out. His eyes, dark as midnight in the gloom of the church, pierce through me in an unsettling way that seems all too familiar. There are lines on his face, bracketing his mouth, across his forehead, and at the corners of his eyes, but his hair is still jet black. Not a gray hair in sight. He looks fit, too. Like he's kept himself in shape. He always was a vain bastard.
If you're gonna hit me, get on and do it, eh? We've got a lot to talk about, and I don't see any point in wasting time posturing.
Posturing? Laughter bubbles up the back of my throat. That's what he thinks this is? Some sort of pissing contest between a hormonal teenager and his hard-done-by old man? He was about to call my mother crazy, but he's the one with the fucking screw loose. I let him go, shoving him roughly as I get to my feet. You shouldn't have come back here. You're not wanted. You're not fucking welcome. I walk away before I can do something stupid. I've dreamed of this moment so many times over the years, how I was going to take great pleasure in beating the ever-loving shit out of him for everything he did to us, but now that the opportunity has presented itself, I see it for the bad idea that it is. If I give myself permission to hit the sack of shit today, in this state of mind, I'm not going to be able to stop myself. I'll fucking kill him. And where will that leave me, rotting in a jail cell for the rest of my life, unable to hold silver in my arms again? Yeah, fuck that. He isn't fucking worth it. I'm halfway to the church exit when it dawns on me that he's following me.
Don't you want to know how I knew you were here?
He asks. No.
The bike out front. The scout. It's just like the old Indian I used to have. First motorcycle you ever rode on, Alessandro. Who else would have a bike like that around here? And who'd be dumb enough to actually ride it in this kind of weather?
What, you think it's some kind of homage? Some kind of sign? I slammed through the doors out into the sheet rain that started to fall while I was inside. I barely remember you being at the house. Why the fuck would I remember what kind of bike you had?
You're full of shit, kid. You remember just fine.
He grabs me by the shoulder, attempting to spin me around, but I knock his hand away. I'm genuinely surprised that he'd even try and touch me.
Don't. Don't do that. Don't call me kid, son, none of it.
He rubs at his bottom lip, grinning broad as you like. He's soaked from head to toe already, the shoulders of his leather jacket turned dark with the rain, the front of his t-shirt plastered to his chest.
What you want me to call you then? Fucking Sparkles?
Ha, so funny. He's actually fucking enjoying this. I lunge forward, getting up in his shit. I tower over him, 4 inches taller than he is. I'm bigger than him, too. Much, much bigger. He's 45 years old, and he hasn't been in a fight in a very long time. At least not a proper fight, with someone who truly hates his stinking guts. I could tear him limb from limb, and I am this fucking close to doing it. Giacomo shakes his head, feigning disappointment. Can't tell what he's disappointed about, and I don't really care. All I know is that I need to get away from the piece of shit before I lose all sense of reason and logic. In case you forgot, they're burying Ben today. I grit out between my teeth. Over at Greenwood. How about you do me and him both a favor and you stay the fuck away, yeah? There's too little too late, old man. And then there's this. He doesn't follow after me again. He stands in the church parking lot, hands in his pockets, his eyes following me as I storm over to my bike, jam my helmet on my head, start the engine, and I tear away through the rain. It isn't until I'm halfway to the cemetery that I process the fact that my father's leather jacket bore a Dreadnought's MC patch on its sleeve.
6. Silver. I'm doubled over with worry, heart sick and miserable as the priest begins the service. It's so wrong that I am the only person here. Ben had lots of friends at school in Bellingham. A few of their parents reached out, asking if it would be okay if they brought their kids along to say goodbye, but Alex shut them down. He made the excuse that funerals were no place for 11-year-old kids, and he was right, but many of Ben's teachers had wanted to come too. He'd flatly refused to have any of them at the church or at the cemetery. I'd had to fight tooth and nail to be able to come myself, and now, this? An empty church? And a dour, tufty-haired old coot mumbling distractedly over Ben's coffin, doing his best, but not doing good enough? Ben deserves so much more than this. I haven't stopped crying since I sat down, and the priest began to speak. My eyes feel clogged with grit, which is why I don't notice the person sidling their way down the pew toward me until they're almost on top of me. It's Dad, of course. He smiles sadly as he sits down, wrapping an arm around my shoulders and pulling me into his side.
"Didn't feel right sitting at home," he whispers.
I'm so relieved to see him I could cry. I'm already crying, though, so I give in and cry a little harder. How many times did I tell him not to come? At least 5 times this morning, and double that last night. He's my father, though. He didn't listen because it's his job not to listen sometimes. He knew I'd need him, so he came, even though I explicitly told him not to. The service is brief, and I float through it without having to think too much now that I have Dad by my side. The priest finds his stride eventually and says some really beautiful things about Ben, stories I never knew about him. How he liked to dance, of all things. That underneath his shy exterior, Ben loved to sing and play the piano for people once he got to know them a little better. He was good at math, and he was top of his class in English. He loved to write fantastical stories about pirates and wizards that made anyone who read them laugh. When the priest announces the end of the service, he tells us in his quiet, soothing voice that Ben's coffin will be taken directly to the cemetery, where another short Bible reading will be read over the gravesite. I listen, nodding my head like a demented puppet, holding my breath to avoid sobbing out loud in the church. The word gravesite nearly causes me to collapse into a heap on the floor at the priest's feet. Every time my heart beats, it feels as though my sorrow is chipping away at me from the inside, a chisel and a hammer slowly whittling me down to nothing. It doesn't matter how many funerals I've been to. I've never been to a child's funeral before, and it's fucking harrowing. How any parent can lose a child and still draw breath is beyond me. Dad takes me by the arm, guiding me down the aisle toward the grim, rain-drenched winter morning that awaits us outside. When we reach the exit,
We both come to a stop at the top of the slick stone steps. Halfway down, Alex is sitting there, alone, his shirt plastered to his broad back, his dark hair soaked, ignoring the rain that's furiously pelting his shivering body.
Here. Dad pops open the large black umbrella he brought with him, passing me the handle.
Immediately, the rain drums against the taut fabric, roaring like thunder.
I'm gonna go wait in the car, he tells me. If you need anything, give me a wave.
Once again, I'm reminded that Cameron Parisi is one of the good ones. Countless times, he could have looked at recent events and decided Alex wasn't a good influence. He could have looked to the future, seen where my association with Alex might possibly lead me, and he could have pulled the plug on my entire relationship with him right there and then. The boy sitting on the steps in the rain has been broken so many times before. He keeps on getting broken, over and over, despite the fact that all he wants is to live his life and be happy. He's angry, and he's hurt. Right now, he isn't the very best version of himself. There's every chance he's about to derail himself in a spectacular way and take half of Raleigh down with him. But that isn't what my father sees when he looks at him. He sees a guy who's lost so much and doesn't need to lose one more thing. Alex's head stays bowed when I sit down next to him on the steps. The seat of my dress is immediately drenched, but I don't care. I hold the umbrella over the both of us, sheltering Alex from the rain, and a small, solemn smile tugs at the corner of his mouth. His eyes stay closed, but he knows I'm here. The loud rumble of the raindrops striking the umbrella is hard to miss.
Thought about coming inside. Wanted to. Couldn't seem to make myself, he murmurs. I heard all of it, though. The guy did a good job.
A bead of water drips from the end of a wet strand of hair that's hanging down in his face. I want to catch it, like it's part of him that needs saving. I want to catch all of him, to keep him safe and somehow carry him through this, the way he's carried me before. I don't know if I'm strong enough, though. I also don't know if he'll even let me. Since he found out about Ben, he's become harder and harder to reach every single day. I lean my elbow on my thigh, resting my chin in my palm, turning to look out over the snow-capped mountain range in the distance. Such savage sentinels looming over Raleigh. Sometimes they make me feel safe here, protected. Sometimes they make me feel trapped. When Max first learned to read, he brought this book into my room every night to read it to me. It was cute at first, but I started getting annoyed by it after a while. He tripped over all the words, and he always wanted to read the same damn thing, The Hungry Caterpillar. After 2 weeks, I could recite the entire thing from cover to cover by memory. I wanted to stick that book in Dad's document shredder. Alex opens his eyes and looks at me. I'm so accustomed to his self-assuredness that the desolation I see in him now makes me feel like I've been knifed in the chest and I'm bleeding out. I let myself be irritated and frustrated by Max ever since he was born. I used to hate having to run around after him all the time. I've loved him, but I've never really appreciated him the way I should. I know that now. Alex, I'm so sorry. This isn't right. None of it. If there was something I could do to turn back time, fix this, fix Ben, fix you, make it all go away. It's pointless even saying it. There's nothing I can do, and we both know it. Alex clears his throat, turning to face the mountain range in the distance, shadowed by the curtains of rain that are still falling.
Don't say you're sorry, Argento. Don't say you wish things were different. This is the way things are. I have to learn to accept that.
Carefully, he reaches out and traces his fingertips down the side of my face, feather light and gentle. I try to lean into him, but he drops his hand, huffing under his breath. In a broken voice, he whispers,
Careful, Argento. Everything I love turns to ashes. Everything I touch falls to pieces in the end.
Firmly, I shake my head. That's not true. What happened to Ben had nothing to do with you. None of this is your fault. You're not cursed, Alex. He drops his head again, smiling bitterly.
I am, though. Aren't I? Come on, let's go say goodbye to Ben.
7. Alex. The small boy standing on the stool in front of the kitchen counter is me. I'm aware of that. I'm also aware that this is a dream. Neither shard of awareness allows me to separate myself from the fact that the sun-soaked, warm bubble in which I find myself appears totally real. I exist both within my 17-year-old body and that of the much smaller 6-year-old version of myself, who sings in soft, breathy melodies as he digs his hands into a fat ball of dough. He grins as he splays his fingers wide, grinning at the thick, sticky mess that cakes his skin and shores up beneath his fingernails. I can feel it under my own nails, covering my own hands. The hands of a boy. The hands of a man. I see from two very different vantage points, through two different pairs of eyes. One pair observes the world as a place filled with wonder and hope. The other can't help but see the promise of hurt and pain in every direction as he casts his gaze.
Are you ready, mi amor? Have you made it just right?
I smell her first. The scent of lilies and fresh summer fields floods the cramped space, overriding the bright, saccharine tang of the icy sugar that floats on the air, and my stomach twists in both excitement and bitter pain. My mother enters the room in a whirlwind of music and energy. Her dark, thick curls are wild, reaching in all directions like vines reaching for the sun. Her warm brown eyes are bright with an electric, contagious energy. The smile on her beautiful face lights up the entire room so brightly that I'm almost blinded by it. I'm completely in love with this woman. This is the type of unconditional love that sons bear their mothers before they discover she has flaws. And the illusion that she's the most perfect creature to ever walk the earth is eventually shattered. Joy washes over me as she rushes up behind me, tickling her fingers into my sides, burying her face into the crook of my neck. I squeal as she pretends to gobble me up.
Who cares about pizza, Passerotto? I think I'll just eat you. Little boys taste the best, I think.
6-year-old me gasps for breath, fighting to get his words out around his high-pitched laughter.
No, mama, no, don't eat me, don't eat me.
The older version of myself only rumbles out half of the sentence, his words thick with misery. No, mama, no. The smell inside the kitchen evolves, the dream twisting, evolving around me like a shifting painting, and now we are sitting down at the kitchen table, all three of us staring down at a pizza big enough to feed an army. My mother folds her arms in front of her, leaning toward my younger self across the worn grain of the wood, whispering conspiratorially.
What do you think, mi amor? Is it perfect? Should we eat and eat and eat until our bellies burst open and our guts spill out like little red snakes?
Young Alessandro giggles, deep dimples marking both of his cheeks. His smile forces his eyes closed as he laughs at the prospect of such gluttony.
Yes, mama. Let's eat the whole thing, and then dessert.
My mother, in her floral print wraparound dress, sits straight up in her seat, jerking to attention.
Dessert? Who said anything about dessert?
She opens her mouth wide in pretend shock.
Did you look inside the fridge, little sparrow?
The little boy covers his mouth with his hands, trying not to laugh even harder. He turns to me, the older version of himself sitting next to him at the table, and he cups one hand around his mouth, whispering loudly,
"There's panna cotta in there. Did you see it?"
I nod slowly, sadly.
"Yeah, buddy, I saw it.
I saw it just now when I snuck a peek inside the refrigerator, even though Mama told me not to. I saw it 11 years ago, before the darkness, and the suffering, and the broken bones, and the prison bars.
You cheated, Mama cries, addressing both of us. That was very naughty.
Her eyes dance with delight.
Dessert is only for birthday boys, you know. I don't think I know any birthday boys.
Two voices fill the kitchen, loud and excited,
quiet and withdrawn. It is my birthday. My mother continues to feign surprise. Is it? Yes! Oh my goodness, little sparrow, I had no idea. You did, I insist. Her smile makes me light up on the inside. All right then, I suppose in that case, then there might be a little something sweet in the fridge for you after dinner. But first, mi amor, I need your help with something, okay? Do you think you can help your mama with one small job really quickly? I never feel more special, more needed, than when she asks me to help her. Excitement blooms in my 6-year-old eyes. My 17-year-old heart beats a little faster. Of course, Mama, I can do anything. I know you can, my precious boy. You can slay dragons and save the princess and make the whole world right again. That's why I love you so much. You're the strongest little sparrow in the whole entire world. Come on, come upstairs with me. This won't take a second. She holds out her hand to the small boy, and he accepts it happily without a second thought. The woman in the wraparound dress with the wild brown curls avoids looking at the older version of me as she takes her young son and begins to lead him up the stairs. Don't go up there, Alex. My voice is so cracked, so broken, excruciatingly quiet. I feel like I'm screaming the words, but the little boy doesn't hear me over my mother's soft humming. I follow them because I have to. I'm pulled up the stairs behind them, the smell of lilies and fresh summer fields flooding my head, intoxicating and terrifying. My legs are heavy as lead weights, resisting the pull of time and what has already come to pass but cannot be avoided. This isn't how it happened. This isn't how it happened. None of this is right. The kitchen was a sun pocket, warm and bathed in the happy memories of my childhood. When I step onto the landing, completing the climb up the tight carpeted stairway, I walk right into winter. There are no happy memories up here, only fractured shards of grief that bite sharp teeth into my skin, twisting in the pit of my stomach, a cold sense of trepidation filling me from head to toe, blue and gray, black and heavy. My mother guides me into her bedroom, the room where she used to swaddle herself up in her depression, only tossing back the covers on her bed when she wanted to scream and curse at me, hate-filled words that never sounded right spewing from her mouth. I enter behind her, and fog forms on my breath. The place is as icy and frigid as a meat locker, as a morgue. My mother is no longer holding my hand. She's lying on the floor, legs contorted and splayed at odd angles, the hem of her beautiful dress soaked red. In her hands, a shining silver gun. Her eyes find mine, swiveling in her head. What are you waiting for, baby? You know what you have to do. It's okay. Quick and simple. Let's just get it done. No. Mama, no. Her eyes roll, too much white showing like a terrified horse rearing before a snake. Everything's going to be okay, baby. It's all right. Pull the trigger and you'll see. We can go back downstairs and have dessert afterward. That's what you want, isn't it? We can celebrate your birthday. Hot metallic fear climbs up the back of my throat, the taste of death. The small boy reaches out for the gun, wanting to make his mother happy, to stop her from hurting. His small hand shakes with uncertainty. The older version of myself steps over my mother, crouching down between the little boy's slender frame and my mother's prone body, but it's too late. He's already touching the heavy steel. He's a second away from taking the gun from her. I clasp my older, wiser hands around his, holding them fast in place, preventing the moment from happening. Don't listen to her, I whisper. This isn't the help she needs. This never should have happened. I'm invisible to the little boy now, though. I'm a future he cannot foresee. Only I can look back on what was and see him, trembling, afraid, wanting to give the brightest light in his world the only thing she has ever begged him for. His small hands cut through mine like my grasp is so much smoke, the irreversible action already pressing forward, appeasing the gods of time. What has already passed cannot be undone. Don't, I plead. For fuck's sake, listen to me. Hear me. Don't do this. We can still make it right. We can change everything. We can set it all right. If we save her, then we can save Ben. I'm lying to myself. There's no fixing this. There was never a way to fix any of it. When I look down at my mother again, her face is a bloody ruin, half her jaw ripped away. A pool of blood soaks into the threadbare carpet, thick and viscous, so dark it looks black. No longer capable of asking me with her words, she begs me with wide, panicked, fearful eyes. Do it. End it. Make it stop. Pull the trigger, Passeroto. What happens next was written in stone 11 years ago, but I can't stop myself from hoping for a different outcome. I wait for the little boy to drop the gun. I hold my breath, lungs seizing in my chest, hope soaring as I pray for him to drop the terrible weapon in his grasp and call out for help. He whimpers, tears chasing down his cheeks, catching on his dark eyelashes. My vision blurs. I can barely see. The recoil nearly takes my arm off. I stagger back, the kick of the gun everywhere all at once. I feel the impact of the bullet in my chest, and suddenly I'm lying on my back in a library, the sound of screaming in my ears. Oh my God, Alex! Alex! I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to. I didn't fucking mean to, I swear! A girl with long black hair and ruby red lips stands over me, her hand fluttering at her chest. Her pale snow-white porcelain cheeks are spattered red. Pain spreads through my chest like the roots of a tree, burrowing deeper, taking hold, wrapping around my bones. The girl with the black hair takes hold of my younger self, pulling him tight to her chest, wrapping an arm around him protectively. It's okay, Alex, it's okay. You did what you had to do. 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 You did what you had to do.
8. Alex. You clean the carbs out? Air filter too? And it's still not turning over? The trailer's a fucking bomb site. I never spent a fortune on the furniture or decked it out real nice, but I kept it fucking clean and tidy. Since Xander moved in, it looks like he's made a few changes. Plates and dishes clutter the countertops in the kitchen, and mugs of half-drunk coffee are busy growing mold at random spots all over the place. Piles of clothes litter the floor, along with empty cartons of greasy Chinese food and crushed beer cans. In the hallway in front of the bedroom door, there's a piece of toast sitting on the hardwood, covered in peanut butter and dust bunnies. A piece of fucking toast. He's only lived here for 14 days. This level of destruction is kind of impressive. Can you get it on a trailer? If you can bring it over here, I can take a look at it. I don't have time to drive out there today, though. Xander's voice is muffled and echoey, like he's conducting his phone call inside a tin can. Lord, who talks to someone on the phone while they're sitting on the shitter? It's obvious to all parties concerned that you're defecating. I wait in the living room for him, back up against the wall, tire iron in my hand. It feels good to have something heavy and solid to fuck around with while I bide my time. Saves me from repeatedly driving my fist into a wall instead, just to feel a different kind of pain. What are you doing, Alex? I don't even like it here. Let's go. Ben's voice has joined my mother's, it seems. My mind tortures me at frequent intervals throughout the day now, adding Ben's imaginary thoughts and feelings to my inner monologue as it sees fit. Before too long, there'll be so many dead people talking to me that my own voice will be fucking drowned out by all the chatter. In the bathroom, Xander ends his call and flushes the toilet, confirming my suspicions. Dirty bastard. The door opens, making the same creaking groan it made when I lived here, and the son of a bitch trundles through the kitchen, slamming about as he rifles around for God knows what. When he staggers into the living room in a vest and boxers, his hair all over the place and a fresh cup of coffee in his hand, I push away from the wall and step out in front of him. His reaction is violent. Dressed head to heel in black, my face concealed behind a ski mask, I don't look like I came here to try and sell him home insurance. Hell fucking no! Xander hurls the cup of coffee at me, launching its steaming hot contents at my face. I'm ready for him, ducking neatly to one side. I avoid the projectile, which explodes against the wall above his television. A quarter of a second later, I have him by his throat, pinned against a rickety bookcase, and I'm hefting the tire iron above my head. What the fuck? Xander shoves me in the chest, but I ain't going nowhere. Gouging my gloved fingers into his esophagus, I keep on digging until I feel something pop. Only then do I ease back. End of the day, I don't want to destroy his vocal cords. I want the fucker to talk, and that isn't going to happen if I render him mute for the rest of his miserable life. Sup, Hawk? I snarl. Thought I'd bring you over a housewarming gift. Xander hacks and splutters, wheezing as he attempts to scramble away from me. Alex? What the fuck, man? I thought you were gonna kill me. Why the hell are you wearing a ski mask? I keep a hold on him, slamming him back against the bookcase again. It's cold out, I say flatly. Plus, I wanted to scare the living shit out of you. I pull the ski mask off, throwing it into his face. Xander's expression is priceless. He's a strong guy. We're matched in a lot of ways. He knows how to fight. He taught me plenty in juvie. Right now, he can feel the rage rolling off of me, though, and has put him on the back foot. He scowls, throwing a half-hearted jab into my ribs. When I lean forward, putting all my weight against his throat again, he quits any ideas of fighting back. You've been a whiny little bitch ever since I showed up in Raleigh, Alex. What the fuck's your problem now? He grouses. Let me guess. You got yourself a paper cut and it's somehow my fucking fault, right? Ha. So much attitude. He won't be sniping at me in a motherfucking minute. He'll be lucky if he still has all of his fucking teeth. You know, spent a lot of time at the cemetery yesterday, I reply. We buried my little brother. He was in a car accident, bled inside his skull until he died. It was a whole thing. Jesus, Alex, I know. I'm sorry. You should have fucking told me the other night. Just let go. He wrenches himself free at last, lurching away, holding his hand against his neck. A pair of baleful dark brown eyes glare at me from across the living room. I know shit's been tough, okay? I know you've had the worst run of all fucking time, but Christ, dude. No need to break into my place and murder me for it. I hold a set of keys aloft, jangling them in the air. Didn't break in. I forgot to mention I kept a spare set inside one of the breeze blocks around back. He catches them when I toss them to him. As for murdering you, I don't know yet. I'll admit, I've been thinking about it. See, someone paid me a visit yesterday. Someone I suspect you're well acquainted with. He looks at me like I've lost my mind, eyebrows arched, top lip curled in confusion. Slowly he paces to the old couch I left here when I moved out and collapses down onto it. Spit it out, man, I have no idea what you're talking about. My old man, Daddy Dearest, Giacomo Moretti, you might know him as Jack. He waltzed back into my life for a friendly little chat like he'd never been gone. And do you know what he was wearing when I set eyes on him for the first time in 10 years? Care to hazard a guess? Xander's face blanches white. He isn't looking too well. Leaning forward, he grabs a can of beer from an open case on top of the coffee tables and cracks it open. Alex, I had no idea your old man was a dreadnought. Not until I came out to Raleigh. I'd never heard his name until he showed up a couple of weeks ago at the clubhouse. I've never even spoken to the guy. He tips the beer back, chugging the liquid, and doesn't stop until the can's empty. Wincing, he discards it on the floor, rubbing at his throat. You really fucked up my shit, dude. You could have broken my neck. Ignoring his pussy griping, I grab a beer from the case and sink down into the armchair opposite him, searching his face.
I don't believe you. You've spoken to him plenty, and I'm betting you knew him before, too.
I pop the tab on the beer, holding the rim of the cold metal to my lips.
You know him before Juvie, Xander?
Look, I just told you,
Xander.
He curses under his breath.
Fine. Yeah, fine, Jesus. I've spoken to Jack. I know him. But I didn't know he was your old man until we'd already become friends at Denny. I pieced it together based on the stuff you said about him, okay? And it didn't seem like a smart move to let on that we had ties when you obviously hated the guy so fucking much.
I swill the beer around the inside of my mouth, hoping it'll wash away the metallic taste of blood that's been lingering on my tongue for days now. When I swallow, it's still all I can taste, though.
You contacted him? Told him I was inside with you?
Sure. He already knew, though, dude. It wasn't news to him. He asked you to keep an eye on me?
Xander laughs, letting his head fall back onto the couch. He didn't say much of anything about it, just grunted on the other end of the line. He didn't tell me to do shit. I had your back because we were friends, man. For real. That had nothing to do with Jack.
I don't know if I can believe him. It all seems a little too coincidental to me. I don't have the emotional wherewithal to unpack unimportant bullshit friend stuff at the moment, though. I just need to figure out what Jack's game is and put an immediate stop to it. Because there is some sort of game here. There has to be.
And now? You show up at my place of work? You're enrolled at the same school as me? This is all because we're friends and you wanted to come hang out? I don't buy it.
I told you why I came to Raleigh, Xander replies wearily.
Q owed Monty a favor. He wanted me to register at Raleigh and figure out who's been taking a chunk out of his coke business ever since that stuck-up Casey bitch got sent away. That's it. The end. Jack was never even near this deal. There's bad blood between him and Monty. As far as I was aware, you couldn't pay Jack to come to Raleigh, no matter how much you offered him.
So then what? He just shows up out of nowhere of his own volition one day? That's a load of shit.
Like you said, man, you buried your little brother yesterday.
He was Ben's father.
I hurled a beer can across the room, roaring at the top of my lungs. I wish.
Deep breath. Take a deep breath, mi amore. That's it.
Shh.
Breathe.
I pause a second, waiting for the tidal wave of anger to subside. I wish people would stop calling him that. Giacomo was not Ben's father. He's not my father either. He's a scum-sucking piece of trash that uses and abuses things until he breaks them. He never cared about us before. He didn't give a shit about us when my mom died. He didn't care about us when we were thrown into the foster care system. There's no fucking way in hell he showed up yesterday because he was affected by Ben's death. So don't give me that he was Ben's father bullshit. It won't fucking wash.
Xander lets out an exasperated sigh.
What the hell do I know, man? I'm just doing what I'm fucking told, trying not to get my ass handed to me by dudes with way more clout than me. My dad kicked it 3 months before I was even born, so all this, he says, gesturing angrily at me, makes no fucking sense to me anyway. I'm sorry about Ben. I know how bad you wanted him to come stay with you. For what it's worth, I know you'd have taken awesome care of him, but I don't know anything about Jack coming here. I don't keep tabs on the man. I was hoping things would be cool with us if I came here. So long as you don't try and snap my neck again, I still think that'd be dope. But that is literally all I got for you right now.
I swallow, regretting that I hurled my beer across the room, feeling a tiny bit bad that Pabst Blue Ribbon is currently running down my old living room wall. However, this is all grade A bullshit. Xander sounds genuine. I mostly believe what he's just told me, but even if it is all true, that still means he spent 6 months in juvie with me, knowing way more about me than he let on. He knew where Giacomo was when I didn't. I bitched and I griped and I told him things about my family that I hadn't told anybody before, and he didn't say a fucking word. It wasn't as if he didn't have the opportunity.
I mean, all we did was hang out all day, lifting weights and sparring for fuck's sake. I twist the tire iron around in my hand, watching it spin as I run my tongue over my teeth. After a second, I stop it abruptly, jumping to my feet. Fair enough. Xander follows me with his eyes as I make my way to the door. That's it? Fair enough? Where the fuck are you going, man? I feel like you need a Zanny or something. I don't need a Zanny. I spit. I need to make sure Jack fucks off back to wherever the hell he came from. Monty and my father are not friends. That's what Xander said. When he petitioned to become my legal guardian, Monty told me he owed it to Jack to look out for me, which means Monty's been lying to me, keeping secrets. My temper's on a high simmer as I slam through the entrance into the Rock. For a Saturday, the place is uncharacteristically quiet, barely anyone hanging out by the pool tables. The booths in the back by the rear bar are all empty, which is super weird. Paulie, the bartender, looks like he's seen a ghost when he clocks me storming toward the employees-only entrance that leads to Monty's office. Alex, man, what are you doing here? Boss said you were going to be off for a couple of weeks. I flip him the bird and a cutting grin at the same time, then enjoy watching him trying to figure out the greeting as I push open the door and disappear through it into the dark hallway beyond. Alex! Alex! The door opens again, and Paul calls after me. Hang back, brother. He's got someone in there with him. Alex, are you listening? No, I'm not listening. The moment I saw the other gleaming black Camaro out in the parking lot, I knew my sneaky bastard of a father had shown up here, bad blood or no. If my sperm donor's having a tete-a-tete with the boss, then I want to know what the fuck they're talking about. I'm so done with this bullshit. Dispensing with formality, I don't bother to knock, barging right into Monty's office, only to find Monty pinned face down on his desk by a man who most definitely is not my father. The guy's head whips up, and I'm met with the cold, dead eyes of a killer. I don't even think. I fucking duck, because that's what my fight-or-flight reflex screams at me to do. There's a swift thunk overhead, followed by the sharp, juddering sound of wobbling metal, and holy fucking shit. I look up and there's a mean-looking serrated hunting knife buried an inch deep in the staff notice board, right where my head was a moment ago. Wait, 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 fuck's sake! Monty hollers. Relax, okay? He's just a fucking kid! Alex, get the fuck out of here, now! There's genuine concern in his voice. For a split second, I almost believe that he does actually care about me, and this hasn't all been some kind of game to him. The guy grinding Monty's head into his computer keyboard hasn't even blinked. He's a monster of a dude, built like a linebacker. I've been confronted with some dangerous motherfuckers in my time, but this guy looks like he'd put a bullet between my eyes without even flinching. Zeth, Zeth, I mean it, man, just don't. Alex, get back in the bar and wait for me there. What to do, what to do? Part of me wants to bolt down the hall and get the fuck out of here. But then there's the part of me that's craving chaos and destruction. The part of me that's still reeling from everything that's happened recently. It's the dangerous part of me that wants to break open like rotten fruit and bleed out all of my pain, spilling my tangled guts out onto the earth. I unfurl myself like a cat, straightening up with care, never taking my eyes off the guy. If I walk back that way, I'm coming back with a shotgun, I tell him. Better kill you where you stand then, the other guy rumbles. His voice is so deep and rough, it sounds like he eats a side of glass with every meal. Jesus Christ, this is fucking ridiculous. Quit it, both of you. Seth, sit back down, Monty commands. We can discuss this like the proper business-minded gentlemen that we are. The stranger, Zeth, runs me through with sharp, angry eyes, still staring me down. I'm not business-minded. I'm not gentle. I'm pissed. Sitting down ain't gonna change that. Squaring my shoulders, I take a step forward into the office. Monty grits his teeth, baring them like a rabid dog. Are you fucking deaf, kid? I told you to go. I look him dead in the eye, sharp, cold, and hostile. I just had an interesting chat with Xander. He shed some light on your relationship with my father.
God's sake, Alex, now is not the fucking time. If you want to be useful, go find Q. Tell him...
Zeth tuts under his breath, leaning his weight forward onto Monty's head. The added pressure of such a huge guy bearing down on his skull must be pretty spectacular, because Monty quits handing out his instructions and opens his mouth, yelling silently.
Ever crack someone's head open, kid? Zeth asks. Seen inside their brain pan? Poked around in their gray matter? Pretty fucking fascinating stuff.
Damn it. I'm not happy with Monty, but I don't necessarily want him dead. Not yet, anyway. There are still a bunch of pressing questions that I'd like answers to. I'd take a step forward, ready to snap out a right hook, but Zeth's eyes narrow a fraction, barely a millimeter, and I know it would be a bad idea. He sees me coming. I can attempt every trick I know to try and throw him off, but this guy's a professional. He's played all the plays. He's wise to any deception I might try and throw at him.
The brain's an interesting thing, he continues. Shielded by bone, floating around in all that cerebral spinal fluid, it has the power to create worlds, build empires, inspire nations, but poke at it with something sharp in just the right way.
I didn't come here for an anatomy lesson. He cocks his head sharply to one side.
I didn't come here to teach one. I came here for a bag. Wouldn't happen to know where it is, would you? Black, kind you might take to the gym.
Monty winces, hissing through his teeth, spit flying everywhere.
Keep your goddamn mouth shut.
In a black blur of movement startlingly fast, Zeth reaches around, grabs something silver and shining from the small of his back and crack! A hail of splinters explodes into the air. A curl of smoke, bitter smelling and acrid, rises from the muzzle of the gun in Zeth's hand. He just shot Monty's disc, barely an inch away from the old bastard's face.
It occurs to me, the man in the leather jacket says, that you're not taking this situation very seriously. Forgive me for not making myself clear. This isn't a business meeting. It ain't a friendly negotiation. The bag belongs to me. If I don't get it back, I am gonna get fucking medieval on your ass. By all means, decide how the rest of your day is gonna look. No skin off my nose. I will find what I came here for, and I've always wondered what it'd be like to hang, draw, and quarter someone.
Monty's as still as a marble statue, blinking like crazy. God knows what having a gun go off right next to your face will do to a man's vision, but it can't be good for you.
I,
he stammers. God, he's a stubborn piece of shit. He nearly just took a bullet to the face, for fuck's sake, and that shot wasn't an empty threat. It was a reminder of what comes next if he doesn't start playing ball. Suddenly, I'm far too tired and bored by this whole situation to watch it spiral any further down the rabbit hole. Fuck Monty. Fuck this job. Fuck Zeth and his stupid fucking bag. I have the duffel, asshole, I announce. It's at my apartment. You want it, you're welcome to it.
You little shit. You're fucking dead, Monty hollers.
He can be mad all he wants. He's about to learn just how little I like being manipulated. If Zeth's surprised by my claim that I have his bag, then he keeps his thoughts well hidden.
Take me to it, he demands.
Monty kicks out, trying to hit Zeth in an attempt to wrestle himself free.
Alex, you're gonna cost me 100 G's.
Zeth picks Monty's head up and smashes it back down onto the desk.
Your life worth more than 100 grand to you, asshole?
When Monty doesn't respond, Zeth scoots down and bends over him, getting up in his face.
That wasn't rhetorical. Is your miserable backwater pimp existence worth more than $100,000 to you?
Yes!
Then shut your fucking mouth, stand up straight, and head out to the parking lot. cause trouble and I'll bury a bullet in the back of your head, and the rest of your staff will be dead before your out-of-shape carcass hits the deck. Got it?
Monty's eyes are full of fire and brimstone as he reluctantly pushes away from the desk and stands ramrod straight. He puffs his chest out like he just fought and won the right to stand instead of being told to get up. An angry muscle ticks in his jaw. The cold, hard glare he gives me as he slowly walks out of the office conveys plenty with its leaden weight.
This is betrayal. You're fucking dead to me, Moretti. Don't expect to be forgiven for this.
In all the time I've known Montgomery, he's ruled his little empire with an iron fist. There's a measure of pride he takes in his work, and a level of respect he commands from the people who deal with him. He's never been disrespected like this before, and certainly not in front of one of his subordinates. Even if he could forgive me for handing over this bag so easily, he'll never be able to forgive me for seeing him bettered like this. His shame will turn to vengeance, even though my actions have probably just saved his life. His intentions are irrelevant now, though. I don't want to be forgiven. I want to burn his world down to its foundations.
Zeth gestures with false benevolence for me to go ahead of him. In a grim, sour tone, Monty insists on having the last word. Do whatever the fuck you like, Mayfair. You are not putting me in the fucking trunk.
9. Silver. Wait, you're supposed to be a woman. My mom said you cut some sort of deal in court when Alex was released. The man on the front doorstep spreads his hands out in front of him, palm up, and shrugs.
Maybe your mom wasn't actually there. Maybe she just read the court transcript. There was another Detective Lowell. My sister. Clerks mix us up all the time when they type up their reports.
Sounds like a lie, but I just inspected his ID, and it looked perfectly legit.
This won't take a minute, the detective says. We have everything we need for our case. There are a few small details I'd like to go over before submitting my report. That okay with you?
He's tall and clean-cut, wearing a North Face puffer jacket. The hair on the sides of his head have been shaved to a tight, fashionable fade. He's dressed casually, but there's something militaristic and severe about him. He doesn't give off the impression that I could decline to answer his questions. His authoritative, no-nonsense tone makes it clear that I don't really have a choice in the matter, which sucks because I could really do without this shit right now. I've gone over my statement at least 6 times already. This weekend's been really shitty, Agent Lowell. Can't this wait until next week or something? The guy smiles tightly, not meaning it.
Call me Jamie, and unfortunately, no. I have to present the information I've gathered to my boss tomorrow. If there are discrepancies, we won't be presenting our strongest case to the judge when the time comes. And I'm just guessing here, but I'm pretty sure you don't want Weaving let off with a caution and some community service for the shit he pulled in that gymnasium, right?
Weaving. Nausea rolls through me in a never-ending wave. Hearing that name out loud makes me flinch. Oh, no. I'd love it if he got off with a caution, Jamie. I think it'd be great if he gets released and then tries to murder me again. Hopefully he'll be successful next time. Agent Lowell grimaces, rocking on the balls of his feet. It's freezing cold out. The rain turned to snow a couple of hours ago, and the wind is howling across the porch. I probably should have invited him inside, but so what? Fucking sue me. I'm exhausted. My manners have taken a sabbatical.
Listen, Silver. I know this is all really overwhelming. Talking about what happened must bring up a lot of bad memories, but I wouldn't be here if it wasn't important. What if Jake gets out and it isn't you he comes after? What if he hurts someone else and another assault could have been prevented if...
Rolling my eyes, I head back into the house, leaving the door open behind me. Stop. You've made your point. I just want this whole fiasco to be over. Sending Agent Lowell away only to have to deal with him another time is tantamount to putting off the inevitable. I might as well just get it out of the way. In the kitchen, I pour coffee into a filter, dump it inside the machine, slam the lid closed, and hit the brew button. In the corner, lying in his bed by the pantry door, Nipper bares his teeth and growls at the stranger in his house. Agent Lowell doesn't look anything like a Jamie to me. Curls a lip up at the dog, then leans across the kitchen island, resting on his forearms. He's in his mid-20s, probably. With his dirty blonde hair, neat stubble, and his ice-blue eyes, he's good-looking, and he knows it. Confidence oozes out of him like he's been nailed by buckshot, and he just can't stop the flow. Women of all ages melt when he turns that roguish, half-apologetic smile on them, I'll bet. Jake was good-looking, too, though. I've learned that good looks don't make you a good person. Your appearance doesn't mean shit if your soul's as black as tar. I lean back against the oven, folding my arms across my chest. Agent Lowell doesn't seem to know what to do with my blank stare.
Like I said, there were a few things I wanted to clarify. He trails off.
Go ahead.
You told the officer who interviewed you at the hospital that Jacob Weaving raped you earlier this year. I'm a little confused. If you were sexually assaulted by Jacob, why was there no report on file?
My nerve endings prickle, 1,000 tiny fire ants biting the flesh between my shoulder blades and down the backs of my arms. Seriously? He's gonna pull this shit? I didn't file a report. I was too scared of what would happen if I did. Girls get judged when they use the word rape. In my experience, that word makes a lot of men uncomfortable. I'd already been violated enough by then. I couldn't have handled the endless questioning and probing. I told one person, and he downplayed the whole thing. Tried to make out like nothing unusual happened. Yes, I've come forward now, and no, I don't think that it's convenient timing when Jake's locked up for other crimes. I don't think any of it is convenient. I did what I had to do in order to make it through one day, and then the next, and then the next. That's all there is to it.
Lowell pouts, his mouth pulling down at both corners. It's a, sure, maybe I can see that being true, face.
I want to make this fucker bleed.
Okay, after the incident, you said you went shopping for some items from the pharmacy?
The expression slides off my face. Shopping? Fucking shopping? I went to get the morning after pill because I didn't want to end up pregnant after three different guys forced their dicks inside me. I wasn't stocking up on lip gloss and hair products.
Logical, he says, chewing the inside of his cheek. Very logical. I've dealt with a lot of rape cases. Most girls don't show that level of forethought. They're usually too distraught to think that clearly.
The coffee maker pings, noisily bubbling away as it begins to pour the brewed coffee into the carafe. Meanwhile, a stunned calm has fallen over me. Why are you really here, Jamie? What do you gain from questioning me like this? Zen was attacked. You've seen those photos, right? They don't leave much room for conjecture. She's given her statement, too. Jake's already locked up for his involvement in his dad's smuggling ring, not to mention breaking most of my ribs and trying to hang me in the school gym. Like I said, I gain nothing from reporting the attack now. Jake's gonna rot behind bars for a very long time. Agent Lowell smiles broadly, looking down at the covered plate of cookies by the fruit bowl to his right.
Precisely.
He shrugs.
Apart from the fact that people are fawning over your friend, they're very sympathetic toward her. Her hospital room looks like a high-end florist's. But you?
He makes a show of looking around, hunting for the flowers that I haven't been sent.
They're less sympathetic to your story, Silver. People seem to think you might have had reason to target Jake, some sort of high school vendetta. You used to have a crush on him, didn't you?
A high-pitched, endless tone rings in my ears, muting my thoughts. I can't. He can't really be fucking serious. I scramble to form words, to refute the implications that he's making, but I can't even remember how to speak. Thankfully, I don't have to.
You'd better have a damn good reason for being in my kitchen, questioning my underage daughter without an adult present, detective.
I didn't hear Dad pull up in the driveway. Didn't hear the front door open either. My father charges into the kitchen like a thunderstorm, exuding a dark fury that has Lowell pushing away from the kitchen island, the smug look on his face morphing into a mask of professionalism.
Mr. Parisi, Silver agreed to talk with me. She's a smart girl. She knows that if she's got nothing to hide, she...
Nipper launches out of his bed, hackles raised, barking loudly as he darts back and forth in front of the detective, showing him his teeth. Dad doesn't say a word to call him off. I'd say I've never seen my father look so angry, but I've seen him riled like this too many times of late. He grabs Lowell by the shoulder, fisting his jacket, shoving him toward the hallway.
Nothing she just said to you is admissible. You do not have my permission to be in this house. Get the fuck out before I accidentally shoot you for trespassing.
He pushes Lowell, and the detective staggers back, nearly tripping over his own Nikes. He runs his tongue over his teeth, straightening out his jacket as he backs away toward the door.
Not smart to threaten a DEA agent, Mr. Parisi. But not to worry, I won't take it personally. I can only imagine how stressful it is trying to raise a problem teenager on your own.
Dad takes off his glasses, setting them down on the countertop.
I don't give a shit who you are or who you work for. I swear to God, if you're not out of my house in the next 3 seconds, you and I are gonna have issues.
Lowell's arrogant sneer doesn't slip, not even for a second. Glancing over Dad's shoulder, he locks eyes with me and winks.
We're not done, Silver. Next time, I'll be asking these questions in an interview room, and there will be cameras pointed in your face. I'm sure the truth will come out then. Meantime, you two make sure you enjoy the rest of your weekend, okay?
10. Alex.
Let me out, you fuck!
I know how to drive my Camaro, but Zeth puts me to shame. His car, a mirror of my own in nearly every way, is like an extension of his body as he drifts it around the bend, sliding perfectly in the snow, forcing the contents of the trunk to slam and loudly roll around. The hammering from the back gets louder as he jumps on the brakes at a red light so abruptly that I have to brace myself against the dash. This whole thing, Zeth purposely tormenting Monty, and Monty losing his shit so badly, would be funny if it weren't for the fact that, best case scenario, my boss is going to fire me, worst